Planet Fitness has everything you need to start strong, so you can give everything you've got. From plate-loaded strength equipment and functional training areas to treadmills, stair climbers, and free weights. Our equipment is best in class, and our clubs are right around the corner, so you can make this your strongest year yet. Join the club today and save $28 or more when you join for $1 down, $15 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends Friday, January 9th. Are you coming? Planet Fitness. We're all strong on this planet. See club for details.
Hey y'all, I'm Carrie.
I'm Momo.
And this is Monstrous. This episode contains topics and language that may not be suitable for all listeners, and topics that may be triggering to some. Listener discretion is advised. Are you done over there?
I'm on silent. I'm listening.
Okay. All right. Welcome back, guys, to our final decisive flight of 2025. We are here deep in the heart of December. We're just after Christmas. We hope everyone had a great Christmas. That being said,
I hope they did too. Because we did.
Yep. We had a pretty good one. I was going to say something, but I forgot.
You're so silly.
All right, guys, before we dive into this week, I have a comment from one of our listeners that I want to share. They told me some interesting facts that I did not find in my research about the missing fodder children.
Oh, cool.
Mm-hmm. So this one comes from our YouTube channel and is from our listener, Dragon Girl 15, Dragon 94.
Hey, girl, what's up?
And they said that we had a great video.
Yay!
The Sodder children is sad, but a fascinating case. Here are a couple of additional interesting facts, if we were interested, and we are very much interested. So in regards to the picture of Lewis, they said that this was addressed to the mom specifically, so Jenny. She had also apparently had a brother named Frank Caparani, that might be how you say it, who they said could have possibly been brother Frankie that was referenced on the back of that picture. Which, that is an interesting way of looking at that, because I did not know that the mom had a brother. I didn't find that.
Really?
Yeah. I didn't find anything about either of their siblings. So that was interesting. They further said that the Sodder family had initially suspected him because he lived in Florida. Which, if you remember, there were witnesses who saw the children getting into a car with Florida license plates.
Dang.
Yeah, so that is very interesting. Okay. So the Sodders, initially, like, he was one of the people that they thought could have taken the kids, because like we said, it had to have been someone that knew them, just because of how the whole thing went down.
And poor babies.
Then another point that our listener mentioned is that Jenny's dad had died a year before the fire, and there had been a possible dispute with her brother Frank over their father's estate.
It's so stupid.
Yep. Jenny's younger brother, Jimmy, so she also had a younger brother, was also present at the scene of the fire that morning. And I did not find that in any of my research either.
Dang.
The man who had threatened the family, which was one of George's former employees, had also mentioned in his threat that Jenny wasn't signing the settlement papers. So I think what she's saying, or what this listener is saying, is that there was a dispute over the father's estate. So they were essentially coming to a settlement agreement. But this former employee made that threat and said, Jenny won't be signing any settlement papers.
Oh.
Yep, saying that something was going to happen before she could. That's how I'm taking it. I very well could be wrong.
People just irritate the hell out of me.
Those are two very, very good motives. And I cannot believe I didn't find either one of those.
It happens, money.
That is crazy. So she's in, they then said, thank you again for a great video. So we are glad that you liked it, Dragon Girl. We hope you keep listening to us.
Yes.
And then Aunt Debbie had also commented as well. She said that this story, the Sodder Children, is the holy grail for every conspiracy theory out there.
That's very true. I never thought of it that way.
I didn't either.
Go figure, my sister come up with something like that.
I know. She's so smart.
She is smart. She is so smart.
That's where I get it from.
You sure in the heck don't get it from me.
Okay. Anyway, thank you, Dragon Girl, for your comment. We appreciate it. Again, we hope you keep listening to us, especially because in the next coming few weeks, I have a big episode.
Yes, she does.
That I have been working on, that I've been diving into. And that one, I think, other than JonBenet, is really going to be the biggest name episode.
You already did JonBenet, didn't you?
Yeah. Other than that one, I think that the one I'm working on is going to be the one that everybody automatically recognizes. But as I discovered today in my conversations, there's a lot out there that is inaccurate. And we're going to get that cleared up within the next few weeks. All right. So with all of that being said, guys, I have a theme today that is so incredible and so mind-blowing that it requires us to analyze the entire history of high-altitude crime. Mm-hmm. So we're stepping away from the typical horrors of true crime today, and we're strapping on our detective hats and looking at technical blueprints to close our year out. And we're doing so on the most audacious and infamous act of air piracy in American history. Today, we are going to be discussing the era of the Vanishing Skyjacker.
Cool.
So for a brief, terrifying period in the late 60s and early 70s, the sky became a frontier for high-stake criminals. This era was fundamentally defined by the Boeing 727. An aircraft that became the perfect weapon for escape due to its very unique design. You know what aircraft that is? Okay, good. It wasn't just me. I didn't either. I had to look it up. So the 720.
Remember, I'm just about as smart as a box of rocks.
Well, I figured out the plane because I was looking into our first skyjacker today, and I discovered that there were two others that are similar to him. And that's where I found that this plane is tied to all three of them. So then I had to look into, you know, what plane it was and all of that. So for those that don't know, the Boeing 727's unique air stairs were originally designed to allow the jet to operate without ground equipment at smaller airports.
Cool.
So this became the perfect trapdoor for hijackers. So you know how today when you get on a plane, you have, you know, that walkway that that extends out and attaches to the plane?
Yes.
Okay, well, the Boeing 727 didn't have that. So on private jets, you know, the stairs come out of the plane.
Mm-hmm.
That's how the Boeing 727 was. The stairs were attached to the plane. And you opened them from inside the plane. Which... that's a whole other thing in of itself.
Oh, shit.
So we're going to explore the three distinct archetypes of this era. The legend, the copycat, and the ghost. So today, the centerpiece of our investigation is the one and only D.B. Cooper. So on a cold, rainy day, specifically November 24th of 1971, a man only known only as Dan Cooper, turned a routine Northwest Orient flight into a heist scene. He executed the only unsolved act of air piracy in commercial aviation history, vanishing into a stormy night with $200,000 in ransom, armed with only a briefcase and a pair of parachutes. His crime redefined aviation security forever. But Cooper wasn't an isolated event. He was an archetype. His success created a disastrous pattern that plagued air travel for years. The sheer number of similar hijackings in the wake of Cooper's escape, over 15 subsequent attempts utilizing the exact same air stairs, forced a radical and permanent redesign of air safety protocols worldwide. So we are dedicating this entire episode to the three men who defined this bizarre era. Now, as I said, there were many more, but these three were the definition of skyjacking. So first, of course, is the infamous D.B. Cooper. Then we have the copycat Richard Floyd McCoy Jr., who mimicked Cooper's gear, demanded and jumped exactly 5 months later. McCoy's story is one of spectacular failure in a desperate second act of defiance that ended in a tragic shootout. Major shootout. So McCoy proves that being a trained operative doesn't guarantee success, and he is the stark contrast to Cooper's enduring freedom.
And Planet Fitness has everything you need to start strong, so you can give everything you've got. From plate-loaded strength equipment and functional training areas to treadmills, stair climbers, and free weights. Our equipment is best in class, and our clubs are right around the corner, so you can make this your strongest year yet. Join the club today and save $28 or more when you join for $1 down, $15 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends Friday, January 9th. Are you coming? Planet Fitness. We're all strong on this planet. See club for details.
Finally, the even older, far more chaotic case of Willem Speck. Years before Cooper, Speck proved the human will to escape a plane was absolute. He demonstrated the pure desperation of erasing oneself from an airplane by using a simple penknife to cut a hole in the pressurized fuselage, vanishing into the vast, dark Pacific Ocean. By analyzing the DNA evidence, the technical miscalculations, and the sheer audacity of these three distinct acts, we are finally prepared to solve the central question of this crime wave. And as we close the book on 2025, we are going to dive headfirst into every fact, every piece of evidence, every dead-end clue, and every wild theory across these three incredible cases. Because, like I said, we are unraveling the lasting legacy that is the vanishing skyjacker. So let's set the scene. 54 years ago in seat 18C, on November 24th, 1971, the day before Thanksgiving, a man known only as Dan Cooper bought a one-way ticket on a Northwest Orient flight number 305 from Portland to Seattle. By the end of that short flight, he would have executed the only unsolved act of air piracy in commercial aviation history. He vanished into a stormy night with $200,000, which today, you want to guess how much that would be today?
Yes, please.
You want to guess how much it would be today?
Oh, I can imagine.
$1.6 million in ransom money. And this cemented him as an immediate American legend. It was an audacious crime so successful that the hijacker's very name is a mistake. This mistake, he bought the ticket as Dan Cooper, but a local reporter's misinterpretation of an early wire report, which cited a clear suspect named D.B. Cooper, immortalized him under the wrong name.
I'd be a little upset you gave me the wrong name.
So now, let's get into how this perfect crime starts in C-18C. So like I said, it's 1971, the day before Thanksgiving. Dan Cooper is in his mid-40s, dressed in a neat suit and trench coat. He boarded Northwest Orient Flight 305. His appearance was meticulous, described by flight attendants as a businessman or executive type. He was wearing a black tie, dark suit, and polished shoes. This professional presentation was likely designed to put the crew at ease, contrasting sharply with the often desperate, disheveled appearance of earlier hijackers. So before D.B. Cooper, hijackers were seen as, you know, they were dirty, they were disheveled. By him getting on the plane and looking professional, he didn't raise any red flags.
That's when they should have got the red flag.
Right. So shortly after takeoff, Cooper handed a note to the flight attendant, Florence Schaffner. When she initially dismissed it, he leaned in and whispered, quote, "Miss, you'd better look at that note. I have a bomb."
Rude.
Cooper was calm and professional. He demanded $200,000 in unmarked $20 bills, four parachutes, and a fuel truck in Seattle. Which, like I've already...
Didn't want much, did he?
No, not at all. Which, like I've already told you, in 1971's money, today, that $200,000 would be $1.6 million. So Cooper then briefly opened his briefcase, revealing a messy array of wires, a large battery, and several red cylinder-shaped sticks. While the flight attendant could not definitively identify the contents as explosives, the deliberate display achieved the goal of psychological terror. The FBI would later conclude that the bomb was a bluff and no explosive residue was ever found on the plane, solidifying that Cooper's motive was simply theft. He was not a terrorist. So he said he had a bomb, but he didn't. It was the fear factor.
He just made it look like one.
Right. So the fact that the flight attendant, despite the trauma, remained composed enough to memorize these specific details, so the color of the wire, the type of sticks he used, all of that, provided the FBI with the initial forensic profile of Cooper's planning, which was a focus on visual intimidation rather than actual firepower. So he never intended to actually hurt anyone.
Well, I'm glad of that.
He just wanted them to have the fear.
He wanted to give them... Hello.
Right. The fear so that way they would do what he said. So the airline cooperated immediately, which was the goal. The delay in Seattle was intense. The FBI worked frantically to gather the unmarked ransom cash from local banks, ensuring they only used bills with specific sequential serial numbers so that the money could be tracked later if it was found. The demand for four parachutes, two main and two reserve, were also unusual. This specific high-stakes trade-off was a calculated move. Cooper intended to use the threat of the remaining passengers to ensure the airline met his logistical demands, securing both his exit vehicle, which was the 727, and his escape gear, so the parachutes and the cash. Then, in addition to the ransom, the immediate logistical demand cost Northwest Orient Airlines an estimated $17,000 in fuel, charter fees, and operational expenses while the plane just sat there on the tarmac.
That's crazy.
Mm-hmm. So in total, okay, sorry. So today, that $17,000 would be about $135,990. Just in those three things.
I want them.
Right, that'd be nice. So in total, okay, this entire thing cost them, the airline and the FBI, in today's money, a little over $1.7 million.
That's just crazy.
Yeah. So once the ransom and the parachutes were delivered at SeaTac, Cooper released all 36 passengers and two of the flight attendants. All unharmed. Well, physically.
Emotionally. That's
different. So this release was another highly unusual aspect of his crime. Most hijackers of this area demanded continued control over their hostages. Cooper, however, only required the presence of the two most crucial flight members and the cockpit staff, indicating his focus was purely on his escape plan, not political leverage or mass terror. So now with the plane refueled, Cooper dictated a new flight plan. The plane was to head south toward Mexico City, but with very specific low altitude and low speed requirements. So Cooper was using the Boeing 727 specifically because it had those rare AFT air stairs. These are the stairs, like I said in the beginning, that open from the plane itself rather than having that walkway.
Right.
So Cooper's technical knowledge of the 727's design, specifically that the rear stairs could be lowered while in flight.
Oh.
Yeah.
No.
Yep. The 727, the stairs in the rear, you could open them mid-flight. Yeah. So this was the key innovation that allowed this crime to be conceived to begin with. The 727 was a relatively new aircraft at the time, and the in-flight use of the rear stairs was a little-known operational fact, strongly suggesting that Cooper had an industry connection, because not everyone would have known that. Yeah. So the pilots, William Scott and Bob Radzak, I believe that's how you say it, but I'm probably saying it wrong, to be honest. They had to perform the extremely dangerous feat of flying the heavy jet at night through a severe storm at the aerodynamic edge of a stall, all while maintaining the utmost calm under the psychological stress of an armed hijacker in the cabin. Because remember, at this point, everyone still believes he has a bomb.
That's just rude.
Mm-hmm. So Cooper insisted that the altitude be kept below 10,000 feet, which is extremely low for a plane like this. The airspeed was to be no faster than 150 knots, which is about 172 miles per hour. And the landing gear was to remain in the down position.
You'd have death wish.
Yeah. So flying a jet of this size under these specific parameters in the dark and through major turbulence was a major safety risk that required exceptional pilot skills and courage.
More like stupidity, if you ask me.
Right. So around 8:13 p.m., as the plane flew through the storm, pilot William Scott later testified that he felt a sudden upward shift in the tail section, immediately followed by a light thump over the rear stairs. This was the moment that Cooper departed. The aircraft.
Oh, he said later.
Mm-hmm. So the aircraft was flying over what the FBI would later identify as the rugged, heavily forested terrain near Ariel, Washington. He took with him 21 packages of $10,000 each, bound in rubber bands. So a total haul of $210,000. The FBI later confirmed this was a massive gamble. But Cooper had made two crucial mistakes, though suggesting haste and lack of experience. Among the parachutes, he selected a reserve chute that had been sewn shut for instructional use. This error suggested either a panicked choice in the dark or a...
Planet Fitness has everything you need to start strong, so you can give everything you've got. From plate-loaded strength equipment and functional training areas to treadmills, stair climbers, and free weights. Our equipment is best in class, and our clubs are right around the corner, so you can make this your strongest year yet. Join the club today and save $28 or more when you join for $1 down, $15 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends Friday, January 9th. Are you coming? Planet Fitness. We're all strong on this planet. See club for details.
Lack of modern skydiving knowledge. And then when the plane was examined, the riser strap from one of the parachutes was still attached to the plane, indicating that he may have struggled or discarded the harness just before jumping.
No.
Yeah.
No.
I'm good. You won't catch me doing something crazy like that. No, thank you.
You're lucky you get me off the ground as it is.
The combination of these mistakes suggests that he was a paratrooper, that he was trained to jump from low altitudes into combat zones, but he lacked the specialized knowledge of a recreational skydiver who understands the modern equipment. Now, to truly understand the impossibility of Cooper's survival, One must analyze the physical trauma that he faced in three separate phases. We have the exit, the fall, and the landing. So phase one is the exit trauma. All right. So the plane was flying at a speed of about 190 miles per hour. So when Cooper dropped the air stairs, he exposed himself to 179 mile per hour wind blast. Jump experts and aerospace engineers agree that even if he had successfully lowered the stairs at that speed, the force of the air itself would have been immense. This blast alone could have resulted in immediate flailing injuries, potentially knocking him unconscious before he was ever even clear from the aircraft.
Yeah, think.
Furthermore, the risk of striking the massive T-tail stabilizer or the fuselage itself was incredibly high, potentially leading to catastrophic impact injuries such as a shattered pelvis, fractured skull, or severe spinal trauma.
So that makes my body hurt just here.
I know, right? So his choice to descend in the dark through a severe storm meant that visual orientation, so which is crucial for clearing the aircraft safely, of course, was impossible, according to these experts. Now, phase...
Hey, they know more than I do.
Right. So now, phase two, we have the exposure trauma. Okay, the plane was at 10,000 feet, where the temperature was approximately negative 7 degrees Celsius, which is about 20 degrees Fahrenheit.
Burr.
Right? No, thank you. Now, Cooper was dressed only in a suit, a trench coat, and loafers. So his lack of specialized cold weather gear meant that even a brief exposure before landing would have severely compromised his motor skills.
I get that.
I walk outside in 65 degree weather and I'm freezing.
Yeah, I know. I don't like going out in cold weather either. You know that.
Right.
It takes me too long to get warm.
Now, the human body loses control rapidly in freezing conditions. So the colder you are, the less control you have of your own body. As I'm sure anyone that's been freezing cold knows that. So the combination of intense wind chill and low temperatures meant that his exposed skin could have suffered frostbite within minutes. Then we have the primary threat, which is hypothermia. So experts say that if he landed in the cold, rain-soaked wilderness and was unable to immediately find shelter or build a fire, which is an unlikely feat given the injuries that he, according to them, would have sustained. But
he was laying there like a lump.
But playing devil's advocate here, okay.
You're giving this guy too much credit.
All right. Me, devil's advocate over here. These weather... Maybe, I mean, he could have gotten through all of that without getting hurt, okay? He very well could have been more aware than what the experts say he was, okay? Because we don't really know. Now, the weather alone, get rid of, you know, no injuries. The weather alone would have shrunk his survival window to just hours. So he, injured or not, he would only have had a few hours to get out of there. So now lastly, we're going to step into phase three, which is the landing phase or the landing trauma. The terrain below the plane was rugged, densely forested and mountainous, comprised of steep, heavily timbered slopes and sharp rock outcroppings.
He's probably squished somewhere on one of them rocks.
No, he's not. So the FBI concluded that even a perfect, controlled parachute landing would have been difficult. Not impossible, only difficult.
Y'all giving this guy too much credit.
So given the high probability of being injured by the exit and the lack of visibility due to the storm and the darkness, Cooper would have almost certainly crashed through thick tree canopy. But you can survive that.
Okay, he's hanging from one of those trees, just hanging around.
I mean, how many plane survivors fall from a plane after their plane bursts around them?
I get that, but his parachute caught the tree, so he's just kind of hanging there dangling.
Oh my gosh.
Did you really expect any less from me?
No.
No.
So according to experts, landing in a dense forest canopy without a helmet or specialized gear often results in severe disabling injuries, including broken legs, crushed ribs, and internal bleeding, rendering the victim immobile and unable to seek help. However, okay, we're still going the devil's advocate here. That is not always true. And we learned this in episode 25 when we covered Julian Papet. When her plane burst around her and she fell from the sky into the Amazon rainforest and was the sole survivor of that plane crash.
I remember that episode.
Now, she was injured. She did have her collarbone was broken. She did have, you know, her leg was cut open, all of those things, but she was not immobile. She was able to continue moving and find help all on her own. So, experts saying that is not 100% accurate. The likelihood of that happening is small. Yes. But we have seen it happen. See? Devil's advocate here. There's a good thing in it. Okay? Can't say I'm wrong.
I didn't say you were wrong.
So this medical consensus is the reason that the FBI's official final conclusion, despite the mystery, leans heavily toward the theory that Cooper died within hours of landing, even if his body was never recovered. We'll talk about that in a minute. So the terrain itself became his according to them, the terrain itself became his unfortunate, inescapable tomb. Furthermore, we have the speed and the conditions of his exit that were extreme. Any jumper attempting to exit under those conditions would have been immediately, according to them, slammed against the tail section of the Boeing 727 fuselage, an impact that survival experts believe would have resulted in an immediate catastrophic injury, if not death.
Ow.
Meaning that his survival hinged on a pure stroke of luck. And it's happened. Just saying.
I didn't say it didn't.
So the search for Cooper began immediately, a high-tech manhunt centered on critical clues. The FBI launched Operation Norjack, an operation that remains the largest and most intensive manhunt in history that targeted a single individual in a wilderness area. The immediate physical effort involved over 300 FBI agents, alongside hundreds of National Guard troops and civilian volunteers.
Dang.
They all blanketed the rugged search zone.
Well, now, where was it he was supposed to have landed?
I get into it here in just a minute.
Okay.
Yep, we're getting there.
Okay.
Jumping ahead over there.
Didn't know if you'd mentioned it or not.
No, not yet. So this initial sweep was complicated by the severe weather and the heavy forested mountainous terrain of the Pacific Northwest, making ground search efforts agonizingly slow and largely ineffective. So they were attempting to find the man who had executed the only unsolved act of air piracy in commercial aviation history, but the likelihood in this vast wilderness was small and highly unlikely.
He was a dude unto himself.
Mm-hmm. So the FBI spent over $10 million in 1970s money in the initial search efforts. Are you ready for that dollar value change?
Yes. Surprised me.
Today, in 2025, that $10 million would be worth about $80 million.
I want some.
Yeah. Inflation is a bitch, for real.
I want some.
All right. Anyway.
I don't need a whole lot.
So the FBI profiled Cooper as a local to the Seattle-Portland area with Army paratrooper training, but not a professional skydiver. So he knew what he was doing, but he was not familiar enough with the modern equipment.
That makes sense.
So this profile was built on two things: the specific tactical demands of the jump, which included low altitude, high speed, which indicates military jump training, because military typically jump from low altitudes and at a high speed.
Yeah.
And the geographical knowledge that was required to execute the maneuver in that specific area. So speculation among agents centered on the idea that only a local resident would be familiar enough with the mountainous, unpopulated area between Seattle and Portland, which is...
Planet Fitness has everything you need to start strong, so you can give everything you've got. From plate-loaded strength equipment and functional training areas to treadmills, stair climbers, and free weights. Our equipment is best in class, and our clubs are right around the corner, so you can make this your strongest year yet. Join the club today and save $28 or more when you join for $1 down, $15 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends Friday, January 9th. Are you coming? Planet Fitness. We're all strong on this planet. See club for details.
Where they believe he landed, based off where he jumped, to select it as the viable escape zone. So because the area is so treacherous, they believe it was someone who was familiar with the area between Seattle and Portland.
That makes sense.
Mm-hmm. And then you pair that with the low altitude, the high speed. He was a military man who was from the area. Whether he currently lived there or simply grew up there, he was from there. So the most important clues were left on the plane itself. Cooper's 66 latent fingerprints and a black clip-on JCPenney tie. The tie was covered in over 100,000 microscopic particles, and that included rare industrial elements like unalloyed titanium, bismuth, and strontium sulfide.
Which makes up...
It doesn't, from what I can tell, it doesn't make up anything. They're just different elements. Yeah.
Oh, okay.
And they had just been transferred to the tie. So this microanalysis became a key pillar of the investigation. The presence of pure titanium strongly suggested that Cooper worked in the aerospace, defense, or high-tech metallurgical, I've totally said that wrong, I'm sorry guys, industry, particularly one related to machining or chemical processing. So the FBI theorized that this was an involuntary forensic signature that linked Cooper directly to a specific high technical workspace. As a point of highly technical speculation, analysts have even suggested that the titanium's isotype might link the metal to a specific processing plant, possibly near the Boeing manufacturer. So this speculation stemmed from the fact that the Boeing headquartered in Seattle was a major user of titanium in its aerospace manufacturing, lending credence to the theory of the suspect being connected to the local airplane industry.
Dang.
Yep. So the case remained cold until 1980. 9 years after the jump, when a young boy named Brian Ingram found three packets of $20 bills, totaling $5,800, along the banks of the Columbia River at Tina Bar, which at the time was a popular picnic spot and was about 8 miles downstream from Vancouver, Washington. These serial numbers on the bills matched those given to D.B. Cooper. Crucially, the bills were still grouped in sequential order, so they were never unbundled.
Dang.
This suggested that the money had not been lost at one single bill at a time, but rather had been swept together, still banded, and buried in the river system. Now, forensic analysis showed the rubber bands had degraded over time, and the bundles had been trapped in the shifting sands and gravel of the riverbed. So no other confirmed Cooper cache has ever been found since that 1980 discovery.
Oh, really?
Yep. So out of the $210,000 that he jumped out of that plane with, $5,800 of it is all that has ever been found. Mm-hmm. So as expected, the discovery at Tina Bar sparked a renewed intensive search of the river and the surrounding area. But it yielded no further evidence, deepening the mystery of where the remaining $194,200 had disappeared to.
You want to go on a hunt?
Right. So now, you're going to laugh at this. The FBI or the IRS legally treated the unrecovered money as taxable income for D.D. Cooper.
Oh, my God.
And they filed a tax lien for the amount due.
I can't stand.
I told you were going to laugh about it.
I just can't.
So this bizarre legal footnote underscores the government's official stance that Cooper survived and was still liable for the funds. The IRS's action technically remains in place as a permanent bureaucratic acknowledgement of the theft. But the human cost here is much higher. Flight attendant Tina McLow, who spent the most time with Cooper out of everyone, suffered such severe trauma that she eventually left the airline industry altogether and became a clustered nun.
Wow.
Yeah. Her psychological ordeal speaks to the immense stress placed on the crew, who had to balance strict adherence to Cooper's demands along with their own survival instincts.
Wow, is all I can say.
Right. So Cooper's successful crime forced immediate radical changes to aviation security along with a surge of copycat hijacking. The mandatory retrofit of the Cooper vane and the implementation of the mandatory passenger and baggage screening by 1973. Now, the Cooper vane was a physical device installed on all Boeing 727s designed to prevent the air stairs from being lowered during flight. Which I feel like that should have been in place from the very beginning, but, you know, we live and we learn. So this simple mechanical safety lock made the 727, which was the Skyjacker's aircraft of choice at the time, instantly obsolete for escape, effectively ending the era of the parachute exit hijacking overnight. Now, as for the plane itself, the Boeing 727, tail number N467US, continued to fly for Northwest. And later Braniff, before being retired and broken down in 1984. Thus, the very aircraft that carried Cooper to his infamy also eventually vanished. Its metallic remains melted down, completing a strange physical metaphor for the case.
I'm surprised they didn't put that in the Smithsonian.
Right. Yeah, I found that crazy that they ended up melting it down. So the official FBI investigation was suspended in 2016. But the case is far from closed. The FBI concluded that while they could not rule out a successful escape, the overwhelming odds suggested that Cooper perished in the jump. Their final assessment detailed that Cooper, based on his errors and the conditions, would have landed in a heavily wooded, steep area with inadequate equipment and no support. Now, the mystery has entered a modern civilian-led phase. The precise drop location is still a subject of academic debate. We know the general area, but where exactly, nobody truly knows. While the FBI focused on the pilot's testimony near Ariel, some researchers continue to use modern flight dynamics modeling to argue that the jump occurred either further north or west. These civilian analysts often employ computational fluid dynamic software, the same kind that's used in automotive or aerospace design, to stimulate the effect of the jet weight and air resistance on Cooper's body, arguing the pilot's estimate of the jump point was inaccurate during the storm. Meanwhile, citizen detective groups continue to pursue suspects like Robert Rackstraw. Now, decades later, the mystery of Cooper's identity has focused on two primary suspects, each representing a compelling but ultimately inconclusive body of evidence. First is Robert Rackstraw, who I just mentioned. He's a former Army paratrooper and an explosive specialist. So, he could have made the jump, and he also would have known how to make the suitcase look as if it contained a bomb. Rackstraw became the subject of intense scrutiny due to his vast military experience, which matched the FBI's initial profile. And then he also owned a home in the Pacific Northwest and was known to have used several aliases, which matches the general circumstances of the crime. However, The FBI formally eliminated him as a suspect in 1979, citing a lack of physical evidence linking him directly to the plane. Yet, civilian investigators remain unconvinced. They point to his history of criminal deception and his knowledge of military-grade sabotage. The strongest circumstantial evidence against Rackshaw lies in the cryptic set of coded messages that he had allegedly sent to a TV station in the years following the hijacking, though these were never officially verified by the FBI. Just some information out there. Now, our second major suspect is Kenneth Christensen. He's a former Northwest Orient flight mechanic and manager.
Oh.
Christensen was a darker horse, initially proposed by a civilian journalist. Unlike Rackshaw, Christensen had deep institutional knowledge of the Boeing 727, including the precise operation of the air stairs, a feature that he would have been intimately familiar with as a mechanic. Something that only someone who knew the plane would have known about. He also bore a striking physical resemblance to the original composite sketch of Cooper.
I think they were just grasping at straws.
Oh, you never know. So his supporters argue that Christensen's job in aircraft maintenance perfectly explains the presence of the rare industrial metals like unalloyed titanium found on Cooper's thigh. Now, his profile as an insider with technical knowledge satisfies the most forensic detail of this case. The greatest counterargument is that Christensen, who died in 1994, never demonstrated the need for the ransom money and showed no prior criminal tendencies, unlike the highly volatile Rackshaw. Now, the fact that the FBI never conclusively identified the DNA on the tie as belonging to either of these men underscores the frustrating ambiguity that defines the entire case. So both.
Planet Fitness has everything you need to start strong, so you can give everything you've got. From plate-loaded strength equipment and functional training areas to treadmills, stair climbers, and free weights. Our equipment is best in class, and our clubs are right around the corner, so you can make this your strongest year yet. Join the club today and save $28 or more when you join for $1 down, $15 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends Friday, January 9th. Are you coming? Planet Fitness. We're all strong on this planet. See club for details.
Look good for it. They both could fit it. But they couldn't be tied to it by DNA, but they also couldn't be excluded by DNA.
Yeah, back in those days, DNA was shit.
Right, exactly. Right, exactly. They couldn't exclude them by it. They couldn't include them by it because
they didn't know
DNA was in its infancy.
They didn't know what they was doing.
Right. Now, the ongoing debate over these two individuals serves as the perfect microcosm of the competing theories surrounding Cooper's survival and identity. And as we look to the new year, the hope for resolution rests on evolving technology. Citizen groups are fundraising to use LIDAR, light detection and ranging, and ground-penetrating radar, or GPR, in 2026 to scan for anomalies buried beneath the dense forest floor.
And those are so cool.
I know. So LIDAR, which can map the terrain beneath heavy tree canopy, offers the hope of identifying objects like parachutes or metal containers that were missed during the initial 1970s ground search. Adding to this scientific push, some teams are pioneering for the use of advanced geological and historical climate modeling in 2026 and 2027. This effort seeks to accurately simulate decades of sedimentation and river flow changes to finally map the precise location where the rest of the ransom money might have originally been deposited along the Columbia riverbed. How cool is that?
That is cool.
We just have to wait and see if it's a success.
Probably not.
No hope over there.
No.
I'm invested in the D.B. Cooper story.
I know you are.
Like, deeply. And
that's why I'm just giving you a hard time.
I know. Now, the discovery of the Tina Bar money has shifted focus from the landing zone to the hydrology of the Columbia River Basin. Simultaneously, academic meteorologists are attempting long-term specialized studies using advanced computational fluid dynamics to reconstruct the exact 1971 wind shear, aiming to produce the definitive probability map for Cooper's landing zone. Furthermore, the small DNA sample that was on the tie remains the ultimate prize. In a development right before the close of this year, a key investigative group announced that they are attempting one final ultra-sensitive extraction of the DNA remnants from Cooper's tie.
Well, yeah, DNA's come a long way since then, so...
Mm-hmm, and hopefully they can pull something off of it. So the hope is that this last-ditch effort will finally yield a profile suitable for forensic genetic genealogy early next year, which will deliver the first major break in this case in half a century. And we have seen success in forensic genetic genealogy in older cases, like the Golden State Killer, for example.
Yeah.
So Cooper's tie could be the most valuable piece of evidence in modern cold case history.
And that's very true.
And that tie could ultimately end the case and solve the mystery.
Yeah.
Because if we find out who he was, we'll know. Did he land? Did he survive? Or did he die? Now, Operation Norjack, the FBI's investigation into the Cooper case, was not just a manhunt. It was a sprawling, bureaucratic, and logistical exercise that guaranteed an astonishing, are you ready?
I'm listening.
60 volumes of primary case file.
Damn.
Compressing tens of thousands of individual documents. Yeah. The magnitude of this failure is rooted in the FBI's initial missteps and the sheer complexity of the evidence. So the first major challenge was the lack of any organized central database for the ransom money. The $200,000 in bills was sourced from multiple banks in the Seattle area. And the record keeping was initially sloppy. It required agents to manually cross-reference thousands of sequential serial numbers. This laborious process, which involved printing and distributing physical lists of the numbers to financial institutions nationwide, was ineffective and led to major delays.
Oh, yeah, because they did, like I said, they didn't know what they were doing.
Right. So furthermore, the Norjack Task Force was hammered by an explosion of false leads. The celebrity status of Cooper resulted in hundreds of false confessions from delusional individuals seeking fame. And thousands of calls from citizens claiming to have sighted Cooper or found his gear. Each lead, no matter how remote, had to be tracked, documented, and officially cleared, exponentially increasing the administrative burden. The FBI's meticulous nature was demanded a full accounting of every possibility, ultimately contribute to the case longevity and its massive case file. The file also contains records of sophisticated investigative techniques employed at the time, including the use of experimental polygraphs, forensic odontology, like in the Ted Bundy case, they matched the bite marks to his teeth.
Mm-hmm.
That's forensic odontology.
Yes.
Okay. So though this was later more successful in the McCoy case, which we're going to get into, in early attempts at forensic meteorology to predict the trajectory of the jump. Which, as we all know now, none of that worked, and most of it is junk science anyway.
Sometimes it worked.
Sometimes. But back then,
no. They didn't have a clue back then. Forensics wasn't as good as it is today.
Mike was like, boys, go back to school tomorrow? No, on the 5th.
One more week.
The failure of the state-of-the-art 1970s methods is what ultimately drove the case into the cold storage of the archives, only to be reopened by modern civilization efforts utilizing technology that was science fiction in the original Norjack, to the original Norjack agents. The impending public release of the 60 volumes that is supposed to come in 2026 is anticipated not just as a historical event, but as the final massive data dump that civilian researchers hope will finally contain the overlooked detail that could break the case open decades later. So it's clear, the Cooper case is far from over. But for a period in the 70s, it spawned a movement. The official FBI investigation, like I said, was suspended. Nope, that doesn't go there. Okay, to wrap up our investigation into D.B. Cooper, I'm going to share some final thoughts. D.B. Cooper will forever remain an American enigma. Did he spend the money or did he perish? The lack of a body and the missing cash fueled both the death theory and the survival theory. The death theory is supported by the extreme physical conditions of the jump. The survival theory is fueled by the lack of any body found and the highly specialized nature of the crime, suggesting professional planning. We mentioned the most famous suspects, and both remain, Kenneth Christensen and Robert Rackshaw. Decades later, the FBI's most persistent clue still remains the iconic hand-drawn sketch of Cooper, which is a lasting symbol of the man who vanished, but whose face is known by millions. The discovery of the hijacker's identity won't lead to criminal prosecution due to the expired statute of limitations. However, a successful DNA match in 2026 could immediately ignite a highly anticipated, complex legal challenge in the years to follow, concerning the rights to the recovered $5,800 and the legal status of the remaining $194,000, ensuring the Cooper case remains in the headlines long after the mystery will be solved. So before we move on, I'm going to want to talk about our opinions about D.B. Cooper, okay? Personally, I think he landed, and I think he survived. That's what I think. And before you look at me crazy over there, okay, because I know it's coming.
You talking to me?
Yes.
How rude.
I know all the science and everything that I've just went through points to he more than likely died before he landed or shortly after he landed. But as we know, like I mentioned from episode 25 and other cases, people have fallen out of planes from even higher than he was and they've walked away from it.
Oh, I know.
Yes, they were harmed, but they survived and they walked away from that.
Yeah, but if he fell on those rocks, you know he didn't.
But maybe he didn't. They don't know.
He became shark bait.
They don't know the exact landing point. They don't even know the landing zone. They just know somewhere between Seattle and Portland. That's all they know. They know what the terrain in that area looks like. He could have fell in the trees.
And he could have been speared by a branch.
Yeah.
Died up on the tree.
Right, but they would have found him.
That's why they call them theory.
Exactly. And that's fine. Okay, so I have an explanation, okay, for why he's never been found and the money hasn't been found and there was never any evidence that he landed. I believe he had an accomplice.
I think he threw the pilots out of the plane and just kept on going.
No, he did. Oh, my God.
Kidding.
Okay, so I think he had someone on the ground waiting for him to land.
Could be.
I think he scoped out the area ahead of time, and he knew exactly where he was going to jump from and exactly where he was going to land before he ever stepped foot on that plane.
Oh, yeah, he already had it figured out.
And his accomplice was there at that exact point on the ground waiting to pick him, the money, and his gear up. Then they hopped on a plane, across the border, and never look back.
We're going to Mexico.
Now, I know there was $5,800 found. Okay. He had $210,000.
Them few bucks ain't gonna hurt him any.
That's all they found.
Them few bucks that he lost ain't gonna hurt him any.
So, and that kind of, that's one of the many reasons that I think he did land. Because where's the rest of it? Why is out of over $200,000, $5,800 all that's found?
I think he purposely did that.
And he very well could have done it. Purposely done it to make it look as if he died.
Mm-hmm.
But I fully believe that he survived. Because we've never found his gear. They've never found a body. Never found anything he was wearing aside from what was on the plane. Got you thinking, don't I? You're questioning your stance over there, ain't you?
No.
You think he died, huh?
In my opinion, yes.
And you're not alone on that. A lot of people believe he died.
I think he has, if they would go look, his body's hanging from a tree going dee-dee-dee-dee-dee.
Maybe. And that's the two sides of this. A lot of people think he died, like you do. And then a lot of people think
he survived. And I could be wrong. I could very well be wrong.
Oh, yeah, I could be too. That's
maybe the first time I'm wrong.
Right? That is my personal belief. Maybe one day we'll see which one of us is right.
You just never know.
Right. So now let's look at the skyjackers who followed in his turbulent wake. The immediate success of Cooper's impossible escape unleashed a brief but terrifying era of imitation. The sheer audacity of Cooper's successful parachute jump inspired at least, like I said in the beginning, 15 different copycat attempts.
Oh, that don't surprise me.
Attempts.
Everybody wants their 15 minutes of fame.
Oh, yeah, because he was cemented into history. Everybody wants to be just like him.
Right.
So this created a national crisis that mandated immediate government intervention. The FBI suddenly found itself battling a new form of organized crime, the opportunistic airborne criminal.
That's just wild.
So the most famous of these imitators and the man most frequently confused with D.B. Cooper was Richard Floyd McCoy Jr. On April 7th, 1972, less than 5 months after the Cooper jump, McCoy boarded United Airlines Flight 855 from Newark, New Jersey, headed for Los Angeles, California. Like Cooper, he registered under an alias, and his was James Johnson, before executing a scenario nearly identical to Cooper's. He brandished what appeared to be a hand grenade, which it was actually a dummy grenade, and a pistol. He demanded $500,000 in cash and requested 4 parachutes.
You only need one.
But like Cooper, McCoy wore a disguise and targeted a Boeing 727 with the rear air stairs. He successfully parachuted out over Utah and vanished. So the FBI was furious that their changes had not prevented the jump, but they learned quickly. The agency had already established the NORJAG task force and applied the lessons learned from the failed Cooper search to the McCoy case. So they're fast learners over here at the FBI, okay? Unlike Cooper, McCoy was notably sloppy and made crucial mistakes beyond the original hijacking. So the FBI learned that McCoy was a former Army Green Beret, a veteran of Vietnam, a demolition expert, and bizarrely, a Sunday school teacher of all things.
Now there's a combination you don't see every day.
Right. He was also a highly experienced skydiver.
Hey, ain't jumping out, no flipping way.
His military and skydiving expertise meant that he was more technically proficient than Cooper was, but his professional life was far less guarded. He was a National Guard warrant officer who flew helicopters, giving him the perfect alibi and training, but he was also prone to boastfulness and financial strain. So while descending, McCoy was so rushed that he failed to securely clip the steering toggles onto one of his main parachutes, meaning that he was lucky to survive this. His expertise in the jump was marred by a panicked exit, which allowed the FBI to narrow down their search area based on his trajectory. So the day after the jump, FBI agents traced a small slip of paper left on the plane, which was a deposit slip from the ransom bundle. This was McCoy's first major operational blunder, leaving bank-specific paperwork that led the FBI straight to the source of the ransom withdrawal. They found fingerprints on a magazine that McCoy left behind, and critically, his skydiving colleagues recognized the specific method he used to tie the parachute packs. So the FBI quickly identified McCoy through his military and local skydiving circle connections. His colleagues reported his unusual interest in the Cooper case and his tendency to talk about executing the, quote, perfect crime. McCoy was quickly identified and arrested just 2 days later. The FBI found $499,970 of the ransom inside his home, hidden in a briefcase, which this today would be $3.8 million. So the fact that he hadn't even attempted to use the money further proved the crime was a stunt executed for the thrill and the fame that was associated to the Cooper legend rather than him actually needing money. Now, beyond the deposit slip and the distinct parachute packing style recognized by his colleague, the final bizarre piece of forensic evidence linking McCoy to the crime was simple. It was a
an idiot.
Nope. It was a sandwich.
A flipping sandwich.
Mm-hmm. During the flight, McCoy had requested a specific type of sandwich, and he left leftovers behind. Investigators were able to match a discarded piece of food to a partial digestive sample found in McCoy's stomach, which, combined with the other evidence, proved his identity beyond any doubt. So this almost mundane error was the final proof that destroyed his perfect crime facade. And the only part of the money that he spent was a small amount to purchase a Zippo lighter, which they never recovered.
I'm sorry, if I must steal that kind of money, I'm going to go off to the bank.
All he wanted was a Zippo lighter, and they don't even know what happened to it.
Not the Brits crayons in the boxes, are they?
Yep. We love a dumb criminal.
We do.
So his capture provided immense relief and served as a crucial data point for the Cooper investigation. It proved that a highly trained military operative could be caught if they made mistakes.
It's not like he didn't make any.
Right. Now, the FBI briefly considered McCoy as a suspect for the original Cooper case, but he was ruled out by that DNA on Cooper's tile. On Cooper's tie, along with fingerprint evidence. Now, despite the forensic proof, the public confusion was so strong that two Utah County probation officers wrote a best-selling book titled D.B. Cooper, The Real McCoy, insisting that they were the same man, even though he was ruled out by DNA. Now, McCoy, for his hijacking crime, was sentenced to 45 years in prison.
Hello.
However, his story does not end there. In a stunning display of defiance and expertise, McCoy orchestrated an incredibly dramatic escape. In 1974, he was serving his sentence at the federal penitentiary in Lewisburg, Pennsylvania. Working in the prison's print shop, he successfully crafted another fake grenade, this time out of toothpaste and plaster. And he used it to orchestrate an incredibly dramatic escape from a maximum security prison. He then stole a Bell 206 Jet Ranger helicopter, flew it to a secluded spot, and went on the run. This prison escape was a logistical masterpiece, requiring outside help to stage the helicopter theft and coordinate the timing. So he did not do this alone, okay? His military training, particularly his knowledge of explosives and aviation, allowed him to pull off a feat previously thought impossible. Nothing is ever impossible. Remember that.
I know.
McCoy was finally located and killed in a shootout with FBI agents in Virginia 3 months after his prison break.
He didn't get very far, did he?
Mm-mm. He died resisting arrest, choosing a violent end over capture. His death provided definitive closure on the nation's most famous copycat, but the D.B. Cooper mystery lived on, untouched by McCoy's violent end. McCoy's case became a cautionary tale for the FBI. Even the most skilled operative is susceptible to human error and psychological pressure. Now, on the other side of that coin, while McCoy proved that some skyjackers could be caught, D.B. Cooper's true parallel lies in a complete, utter, baffling disappearance. So this one takes us back in time to the mystery of Willem Speck. This incident occurred years before Cooper, on the night of November 17, 1965, on a Pan Am Boeing 707 flying from Pago Pago, Samoa to Honolulu, Hawaii. The plane was carrying 88 passengers and crew. The hijacker was Willem Speck, a 34-year-old German immigrant. Speck didn't demand money. His motives were purely political and delusional. He wanted the captain to fly to Hanoi, North Vietnam.
Hanoi.
Okay.
Yeah, that's a tough word.
The way it's spelled.
Right.
Captain to fly to Hanoi, North Vietnam, which was nearly impossible due to the plane's limited fuel and the ongoing Vietnam War. When that failed, he demanded that the plane fly to Castro's Cuba. Speck.
Castro don't want you either, Bubba.
According to reports, Speck was completely erratic. He was only armed with a small penknife and a bottle of what he claimed to be nitroglycerin, a substance that investigators later identified as actually being a cocktail of soap, gasoline, and alcohol. His simple weapons contrast sharply with the later, more sophisticated military tactics of Cooper and McCoy. His demand was rejected, and the captain was ordered to proceed on to Honolulu. What happened next cemented the case as a truly unique disappearance. As the plane approached Hawaii, Speck, wearing an airline life vest, retreated to the near lavatory. The crew had heard strange noises, and they smelled gas. And when the lavatory was finally secured, it was empty. Speck had used his penknife to cut a hole through the metal fuselage directly beneath the lavatory window, exposing the aircraft exterior. Speck's methods of escape was to simply cut a hole in a pressurized air cap with a freaking penknife, of all things, at 24,000 feet. This is not just difficult, but it's an act of extreme, almost suicidal effort.
You think?
That required battling basic principles of aeronautical physics. A Boeing 707 at that altitude, okay, maintains a cabin pressure equivalent to about 8,000 feet. So this means that the pressure inside the fuselage was dramatically higher than the thin air outside.
Yeah.
So when Speck pressed the metal skin, that pressure differential instantly began fighting against him. So the force required to cut through the aluminum alloy of the fuselage while simultaneously bracing against the escaping cabin air that was trying to suck his body out would have been enormous. Experts in this theorize that Speck would have had to cut a hole large enough to accommodate for his body, which have had to have been roughly 18 to 24 inches in diameter, all while the air was actively rushing past the blade he used to cut it open. Something that seems completely impossible. But he did it.
Not real bright, yeah, me.
So the sudden release of pressure, known as rapid decompression, would have created a shockwave and a dense fog inside the cabin as the humidity condensed. So Speck would have experienced temporary severe disorientation, making the final push to exit even more desperate. This act of forced egress against a pressure gradient is a crucial distinction from Cooper's jump. Cooper simply leveraged an exiting controllable point, while Speck literally fought the integrity of the aircraft in order to get out of it. His act was a moment of pure, raw desperation that highlights the difference between a planned tactical exit and a complete violent alienation of self.
He didn't like himself very much, did he?
No. So crucially, this created a severe localized decompression threat to the pressurized cabin. Now, after this, he then either forced himself through the opening or somehow slipped through it, but then he fell into the open Pacific Ocean, somewhere roughly 200 miles south of Hawaii.
Yeah, you know, these copycats would just kill me.
Well, he wasn't the copy. He came before Cooper.
Oh.
Yep.
I missed that part. Still not real bright.
No, definitely not. Copycats aren't any better, to be honest. So Pan Am later estimated the repair and operational loss from the damage and delays of this. So they said that it totaled about $10,000.
Yeah, but I can't figure out how he would get through that metal with a
I don't know.
Thin knife.
He did, though.
Most thin knives, just don't look at that metal and go,
It seems impossible, but he did it.
Yeah, pin knife going, you don't pay for this sucker.
Now, unlike Cooper, who had jumped with military-grade parachutes over a dense forest, Beck disappeared wearing only a life vest. over miles of dark, freezing open ocean water.
He became Sharpie.
Yeah, pretty much. So he left behind his shoes and jacket, and a life vest had been discovered later punctured with holes.
Shark bait.
Specht's act was the definition of desperation and likely suicidal.
Yeah, that sounds more like it.
Mm-hmm. Yet, just like Cooper, he completely vanished. No body was ever recovered.
Because he got ate by sharks. I mean, come on now.
His disappearance provides a dark contrast to Cooper. One man used sophisticated military training to vanish over land for money.
And one man was just stupid.
Yep. The other used raw desperation and a small knife to vanish over the vast ocean for a political pipe dream. In the end, Specht's escape was a suicide attempt disguised as a flight. The plane was flying at 24,000 feet, meaning the temperature outside was approximately negative 30 degrees Celsius, which in Fahrenheit is negative 22 degrees.
Hell no.
You probably just broke everybody's ears.
I don't care. I don't even like going outside with the temperature in.
I'm not sure, you'd have to look.
It's 24 degrees right now.
Sorry, guys.
No.
She's a little excited over there.
No. No.
And then the area where he fell was subject to severe wind shear and turbulent conditions.
No.
Yeah.
No.
So even surviving the initial fall into the open ocean, which is likely impossible.
He became a popsicle for a shark.
I mean, he cut through a plane with a penknife, so.
He became a popsicle for a shark.
So even though this was virtually impossible due to the impact, if he had somehow survived the fall and the impact, because his story.
He was one lucky SOB.
Right. His story shows us that the impossible.
Is possible.
Is possible. The water temperature below, which was far below the threshold for long-term survival, would
right.
have eventually killed him.
Oh, yeah. Hypothermia would have ate him up.
Yes. So Speck was not only over 200 miles from the nearest landmass, which was Hawaii, but the temperature meant anybody would have succumbed to hypothermia, like you said, within minutes.
Sure.
Solidifying his fate as an unrecoverable ghost of the sea.
He's down there playing in Atlanta. He's down there playing with the king and the mermaid.
Okay, anyway. So the failure to recover Speck's body, despite the location being over open water, emphasizes the devastating effects of high altitude impact and the rapid dissipation of human remains in the vastness of the Pacific. It's kind of hard to find a human body in the ocean.
Like I said, he's down there playing with the mermaid.
So together, these three vanishing acts. I can't. So together, these three vanishing acts demonstrate the terrifying vulnerability of aircraft in that era and the extraordinary lengths that individuals would go to disappear without a trace. These crimes fundamentally broke the perception of air travel as safe and necessitated an unprecedented, coordinated government response, resulting in the security architecture that we rely on today.
I mean, well, they just change it. Now you have to have a real license just to fly.
Yeah.
So,
mm-hmm.
Which I need to go get that done.
You keep saying that, but you have yet to do it.
I know, it costs money.
So the most immediate change following this was technical. The mandatory retrofit of the Cooper vane that I had mentioned, formerly known as the Cooper safety strap on every single Boeing 727. I had talked about that
earlier
when we talked about Cooper. This simple mechanical pin, actuated when the landing gear was up, prevented the rear air stairs from being lowered during flight, thus eliminating the jump tactic forever.
Well, that's a good thing.
Which now today, most of the planes don't even have the stairs inside. It's just a
tunnel
mm-hmm.
that
yep.
you go through.
Yep.
And the security alone, after all, what these fools did.
Oh, yeah, I know.
You know.
So legislatively, the U.S. Congress, spurred by the wave of post-Cooper skyjacking, which peaked in 1972, enacted the Air Transportation Security Act of 1974. So this legislation mandatory screening, Then by 1973, it became federal law to require every passenger and every piece of carry-on baggage to be electronically scanned before boarding.
Oh, yeah.
Before Cooper, security checks were virtually non-existent.
Now they just kind of go, keep moving.
Yep, you're
keep
good.
Keep moving.
Yep, now they, you know. Now we also have armed marshals. That was given to us by this.
Oh, yeah.
The Federal Air Marshal Service was dramatically expanded and revitalized.
I believe there's an air marshal on just about every flight. I know they are international, but domestic, I'm not sure of.
I want to say they're usually in plain clothes.
Yeah, you don't know.
So I want to say that there's one on almost every flight, but it could just depend on where you're flying to or from.
Right. Now, I couldn't, you know, from flying from out of there to, say, Chicago, I don't see one on there.
I wouldn't think so, because it's...
What, a 10-minute flight?
Yeah,
15-minute flight?
Because the closest airport to us is not an international airport.
Right, where Chicago is.
Yeah.
But I could see, there could be. I could see them up in Cedar Rapids or, you know, Des Moines.
Mm-hmm. Maybe.
Hey, you never know, sweetheart.
Right.
People are freaking crazy.
Because they're undercover, and that's the purpose. You're not supposed to know that.
Right. People are freaking crazy. And
right.
Some of the videos I've watched from people getting on the plane and being ugly to each other, and it's like...
Can we just travel in peace, please?
Thank you. I just want to go see my grandchildren. Thank you very much. Or go see my sister.
Right. Or I just want to go home. Like, I don't want to deal with this.
It's really...
Yep. So...
Knocking in the head.
Placing... So this part of the act placed armed covert law enforcement officers on what are classified high-risk flights.
So which would be international.
Right, definitely international. And like I said, it could be just depending on where you're going or coming
what's
from.
What's on, what's being shipped on, because, you know, a lot of times they ship stuff on planes.
Right.
So depending on what's being shipped, who's on the plane.
Right.
You know, a lot of it is VIPs that you don't realize. They're up in first class where I'm back in coach.
Right.
Yeah.
So it's hard to, if we have any marshals or flight people that know, let us know.
Really? Because that's really curiosity.
Right. I'm curious. Is it all flights? Is it certain ones? I'm curious.
Me too. It'd be something neat to know.
Right. So if you know, shoot us a message. Let us know.
If you can tell.
Right. If you can, because they may not be able to. It also, get back to this. So it also created those physical barriers. So like the cockpit doors, which until I did this case, I didn't realize that at one point those cockpit doors didn't exist.
No, they used to be open.
Yeah, I didn't know that. That's crazy to me. So this act created those.
Well, you've only flown a couple times.
I've flown quite a few times.
But not back.
No. Not before this was created. No. I mean, I wasn't even thought of when this came to be. So
no, you were.
So these, what they did have when flights did have them, they were either left open or they were real flimsy. They weren't secure like they are today.
And a lot of times, too, back then, if there was children on the flight, they'd take them up to the cockpit so they could see the pilot, and they'd
that
get little wings and stuff. Yeah, I don't know if they still do that.
I don't think they do because when Brooklyn and I flew out to North Carolina with Papa, I was what, 16? 15,
I'm talking 16? Like the boys' age.
Well, Brooklyn would have been little.
Yeah, she'd only been 10.
Yeah. So and we were unaccompanied minors. So, I mean, we got, you know, on the plane first, you know, all the stuff that comes with that.
You got special treatment.
Right.
Because the flight attendant kept sit there, you guys.
Right, because it was just the two of us. But they never, I think the pilot might have come and spoken to us.
Maybe.
If I remember, one of the pilots had come and spoken to us, but that was it.
Yeah, but like I said, that was before you were born, honey.
Right.
So
you got to move that closer, Mom.
Oh, sorry. So they may have changed things a lot since then because of all the craziness and people
right.
being stupid.
Right. So I don't think that's something they do now. But it could just also depend on the airline too.
True. On the pilot, you know.
Yep.
If they've got an upset child, they may do it just to calm him down.
Right.
So he won't be so scared of flying.
Right.
I'm terrified of heights. I always have been. That's why I thank God he made me short. But now I can fly. It don't bother me.
Taking off and landing is what
gets me.
I'm just like, huh.
Once I get in the air, I'm fine.
It's the turbulence in it that is, I'm just like, oh God, I'm going to fall out of the sky. I know I'm
it's actually safer to fly than it is to drive a car.
It really is. Yeah.
Because people are stupid when they drive.
I know.
That's a whole other subject.
Right. Okay. Anyway, sorry. Back to this. So those cockpit doors are now significantly reinforced and they're fitted with locks and they're locked from inside the cockpit. So that way hijackers can't seize control of the flight deck.
Right.
So.
And they are, if something happens, they are not to open those doors.
No. From my understanding, yeah, that's what the protocol is. They are not supposed to open those doors under any circumstances.
Yep.
Yeah. So the financial and bureaucratic investment in security after all of this was staggering, to say the least. Before Cooper, the cost of implementing airport security measures was often borne by the individual airlines themselves.
Right.
But after the federal mandate, massive funding was required to install X-ray machines, metal detectors, and employ thousands of new security personnel. So
TSA.
Yeah. So the financial burden of all of those things became federally funded rather than private by the airlines.
Because
they realized that there was a problem.
Yeah.
Yeah. So the legal fallout from the Cooper case, even after the FBI suspended the investigation, still continues today, particularly concerning the ransom money. The unrecovered money remains legally categorized as stolen property. If ever found, the money would be automatically returned to the insurance company that paid out the claim or to its successor, not to the public or even to the finder, unless a specific legal claim could be established.
Unless there's a reward.
I couldn't find one.
Oh, I'm just saying.
Yeah, there could be. Possible.
They may not just make it public.
Maybe.
Because you put a reward out there and every crazy in the world comes out.
Oh, God, I know. So this legal precedent solidifies the money status as a core piece of evidence, keeping the case technically open. Until the money's found, it's going to remain that way.
I don't think they'll ever find the money.
No, I don't think so either. That shit's long gone.
Yeah. Like that one bundle. If it's in that water, it's disintegrated
by now. It's no good
in it,
yeah. So the D.B. Cooper case also drove a massive investment into the new field of forensic trace evidence. The extensive analysis of the tie, so that 100,000 microscopic particles, was pioneering for the time.
Yeah, it was.
The use of electron microscopes and mass spectrometers to analyze those trace metals for the first time demonstrated how sophisticated forensic science could be applied to complex criminal investigations, with setting a precedent for cold case analysis to come like today. So the contrasting outcomes of the three cases provided the ultimate lessons. Speck's failure proved that escaping a modern pressurized jet without sophisticated gear was almost certainly fatal due to the physics of high altitude pressure, but not impossible.
No, nothing is impossible.
McCoy's capture proved that highly trained military skills cannot overcome basic forensic errors and human psychological weaknesses. And Cooper's success proved that the brief window of opportunity created by the 727's design, combined with cold, precise planning, was, for one brief moment in history, enough to achieve the perfect crime and vanish without a trace.
Crazy.
And that is our Vanishing Skyjackers episode. But we are not finished yet. So from the fiery ruins of the Sauter home in 1945 to the raining, rain-swept sky above the Pacific Northwest in 1971, these stories of perfect disappearances leaves us with the same haunting questions.
Where the hell are these people?
And when the facts defy explanation, where does the truth truly lie?
I couldn't tell you.
And on that note, we're going to finally close the book on our year here at Monstrous. And what a ride 2025 has been.
No kidding.
We've tackled everything from chilling unsolved disappearances, some of the darkest corners of serial killer psychology, weird mysteries, spooky season haunting, witches, and even strange true crime stories that still today defy explanation. And we couldn't do it without any of you. And so we're grateful for all of you coming back every week to listen and support us. And now that we're starting 2026, we're going to do it with a bang. Next week, we are diving into the shocking story of a small town terrorized by a mysterious anonymous writer.
It's a writer, as in a, like a book?
Yeah, like a letter writer.
Yeah.
So it's a case that involves murder, a possible frame up, and persistent threats that continued even after the supposed culprit was locked away.
Dang.
After this episode, you will never look at your mailbox the same way again.
I don't. Mike usually gets mail.
So thank you for joining us for our last episode of the year. Please make sure you rate and review. Send us your case suggestions and listener tales to our email. You can find that along with our Facebook link in the description for this episode. We also have a TikTok video where we give you short little clippets of each episode. We will be back next year for a whole new lineup of horrors, mysteries, and unbelievable true crime. We hope you have a safe and a happy new year. And if you have nothing else...
I think I've said enough this episode.
All right. So we hope you keep listening and remember to...
Watch out for monsters.
And don't kill people. Bye, y'all.
Bye, y'all.